when I look back at it now, it's like you have no choice, but you go into survival mode, and you go into pure survival mode of, okay, things will get better. Things will get better. And I think I shared with you, faith was one of those things that I had. It was, from evangelical Christians that were reaching out to the Hare Krishna temple that was like in our area. I mean, whatever you can, kind of grapple onto, to say, you know what, this is going to be okay. And that was this internal, innate motivation that I had for my younger brother and I, because I literally became the head of the household. My father fell into a depression and couldn't take care of the family. I was at that point, at 17, working three jobs just to support everybody and try to take care of me. And so what I thought and what I valued and what I prioritized was, okay, success, success, success. So when I'm, when I was hustling at 17 years old, trying to get it all done, myself took a backseat for about a decade, which then entering my 20s, I wanted to create a family that I'd lost.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. I know that you have heard me talking about my new book, An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. So I want to tell you a little bit about the book. Have you ever heard an episode of The Unmistakable Creative and learned something and thought you wanted to apply that thing to your life and then suddenly forgot it? Well, this book really is a blueprint of all of the best advice that I've ever gotten from Unmistakable Creative guests for how to improve your habits, for how to be more productive, for how to avoid distractions, for how to be more creative. And you can download a free chapter at unmistakablecreative.com/audience. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/audience. And the book comes out on August 7th. Neetha, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, I'm super excited to be here, Sri.
Yeah, well, I am really thrilled to have you here. I was introduced to you by way of your publicist and was really intrigued right when I found out a little bit about your story and read a bit about what you did. But before we get into all of that, I will start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living and what impact did what they did for a living end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's such a great question. So my parents were actually immigrants. I was born and raised in the U.S. in Chicago, and they came, my dad was, he was an entrepreneur. And so he left India at an early age and, ended up traveling to Nepal and opened up a bar in Nepal. So this has to go back one more generation because my grandfather was the ambassador to UNICEF and he was very diplomatic. And when he passed away, my grandfather had been to about, over 30 countries, spoke 24 different languages, only came to India during the winter months. And so when he passed, he left all of this land for six brothers and sisters, where they only saw their father once a year. And that was for like a month at a time. And so when he passed, my father was probably one of the only entrepreneurially spirited ones out of the family, decided not to take any of the inheritance. And kind of charted out on his own. And so he landed up in Nepal first. And then by way of a pen pal, if you can recall pen pals and what those were, basically, he met one of his hippie friends who was from Madison, Wisconsin. And by way of writing letters to each other, my father ended up meeting with her, and her name was Nancy, and that's how he came to the U.S. and was and then got into real estate and other types of investments. But he was basically a real estate developer. And my mom, on the other hand, she was from the Philippines, and she was very, you know, much in a traditional career. She had a background in accounting and was an accountant. Basically when she ended up in the U.S. So there you go.
Wow. Okay. So many questions just from that.
Yeah.
What impact did the way that your parents raised you, or your father in particular, what impact did the relationship that he had with his father, being that, you know, he was somebody they only see once a year, have on the way that you guys had your relationship when you were growing up?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, I think that because everyone was scared of my grandfather. He was almost, I don't know if you can picture Ed McMahon, but he literally looked like Ed McMahon. He had like blue eyes, very, very light, fair skin. He looked like he was, German, and he spent a lot of time in Germany and Russia and Afghanistan. And so I think that because my dad was not close with my grandfather at all, but they respected him a boatload and tons, because my grandfather, took photos with Khrushchev and JFK. You know, my grandfather came to the U.S. I mean, had all of these dignitaries that, you know, then later in photos and things like that, my aunts and uncles, my dad's brothers and sisters would actually, you know, tend to hear these stories about him. And, you know, that really kind of put the relationship of my father and my two younger brothers and I, we were very close. And so that was kind of the opposite of what my dad experienced with his father. And actually, it's so interesting, because I don't even think, knowing, you know, human psychology and behavior dynamics, I don't even think I've made that connection until you just asked me that question right now. So that's a very informative question. Thank you for asking.
I've been known to do that to people from time to time. you know, the other thing that struck me, you mentioned that your dad was from India, your mom was from the Philippines. What aspects of each culture were integrated into the way that you were raised, and how did that affect you later on in your life?
Oh, yes. Another gem. So growing up in the melting pot of Chicago, and I grew up literally in the city. So I am definitely a city girl, and I grew up there for the first quarter of my life. So my father, you know, was raised Hindu, and he was Punjabi and actually Sikh. So they would go to, when they were growing up, they would go to the Gurdwara, the Sikh temple, and they would also go to the Hindu temple. On my mom's side, you know, she was Roman Catholic, born and raised. Everyone was, you know, staunch Catholics. And so it was very interesting growing up, because my father had this very spiritual view. And raising the three of us in a melting pot of Chicago, where all three of us, we were very mixed looking, and so we were very culturally ambiguous. And so people would think that we were Latin or Latino, or, you know, some sort of Asian mixed, or even mulatto mixture. Like, people wouldn't even know what we were, but they did their very, very best when we were very young to put us into all sorts of things. So we were just like a hodgepodge of going from different piano lessons to Filipino cultural programs on the weekends. The three of us actually danced in a Filipino dance troupe. And then when I got older, we would, with my father, we would do the temple, every Tuesday, and then Sundays we would alternate between the Gurdwara and church. So very conflicting dogmas, by the way. So that would be, that was definitely, interesting, but it informed our perspective, or, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself, but it informed my perspective of a very global view of, oh, wow, you know, at a very early age, realizing that, you know, these dogmas are kind of, you know, similar in a sense of, you know, teaching, you know, morals and ethics and codes and all of these things that are very collective and, inclusive. And so it was interesting that we had that at such an early age, to be open to, you know, not only the different religions that we were exposed to, but also culturally, our family is very mixed. And so a lot of my cousins are also half Filipino and half something, and same thing on some of my father's side. So it was very much a mixture of that. And on my father's side, because my dad loved to cook, we were exposed to Indian food and Indian cooking, which is why I cook more Indian food now than I do. I don't know how to cook much Filipino food, because we were tantalized by my father's chef skills at a very early age, as well as Indian dancing. And so I was in high school part of a, so dance has always been part of my life, kind of growing up from our Filipino dance troupe when we were in kind of like the primary years of schooling and education. And then when I got into high school, it was more so Indian classical dance and Bhangra, and joined all of the teams and things like that. And been choreographing things, even up until my wedding at Burning Man last year, which is a different story altogether.
Oh, well, there's no way I'm going to let you off the hook after you drop that. But before I do that, I'm curious, as an adult, does faith play a role in your life? And how has your, you know, upbringing with multiple faiths played, impacted you today? And have your thoughts on faith changed with age?
You know, it's, I don't prescribe to any dogma. And, I think that, you know, faith really comes from you. And so, you know, I say my religion is love, and being able to, you know, to serve love and be love. And so that's kind of the ways that I actually, kind of live my life now with my partner. But I think that it had many seasons, and it had many different ways that it influenced my life in the different aspects of adversity that I chartered. And so for a while, faith was the one thing that I was holding on to, because it was the only thing that I had. And I know we're going to go into this, but because most of my early years, when I actually went into the adversities of losing my mother at 16, and then losing my brother at 17, and losing my father at 19, in those tumultuous times, faith played a very heavy role. Because, you know, we were already kind of going to all of these different, you know, religious things kind of as tradition. And so, I think for the longest time, we still, my brother and I, we still kind of did a lot of those rituals to keep our family rituals alive, because we had been through such a very, you know, challenging and heartfelt time in our adolescence. And so now it's really about, you know, like I said before, it's formed its way into love, and I think that's what we need more of now.
When you're growing up, given that your father had sort of had this, you know, legacy that followed him from your grandfather, what was the kind of career advice that you and your brothers were given?
Yes. You know, it was, you could only pick four careers, and it was doctor, dentist, lawyer, engineer. and it was, you know, it was very much around, you know, accolades, academics, achievement, overachievement, and, you know, how much you can brag from one person or one family to the next. You know, my father had a lot of pride coming into the U.S. Because it wasn't that you know, he wasn't coming with a traditional story of $5 in his pocket. You know, like I said, he started his entrepreneurial journey in Nepal, and he was very eager to take risks. And, you know, he was good with those types of things, given that, you know, a lot of his own inferences were from my grandfather. But that put so much pressure on us, definitely, growing up, and not to mention, you know, the same thing on my mom's side. Everyone on my mother's side was a pageant queen. So my mother was a pageant queen. My grandmother was a pageant queen. All of my aunts were pageant queens, and even my great grandmother was still competing at the age of 70 in the U.S. So both combined had a lot of pressure to be perfect, you know, have the straight A's, get the first prize, you know, trophy in violin lessons, piano lessons, flute lessons, whatever lessons, dance lessons, and really to strive for being the best. And so that was my programming, you know, very, very early on.
The quality of your sleep is one of those things that impacts nearly every area of your life, from your emotional well-being to your ability to focus to your creativity. After more than a year of sleeping on it, I think the Casper mattress is hands down one of the best investments I've ever made in the quality of my sleep. Even after sleeping on a bed in the nicest of hotels, I always look forward to sleeping on my Casper mattress because it's made that much of a difference. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. The prices are affordable because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you. It's hassle-free to return, and they offer free shipping and returns in the US and Canada. And you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on a trial. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable. Again, that's casper.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable. Terms and conditions may apply. So two questions come from this. Did you feel a sense of obligation to fulfill the things that your parents wanted as a result of this programming after they were gone?
Oh, 1,000%. I think that, you know, I talk about this a lot when I'm up on stages, but it was kind of the ghost that was, you know, of their spirit that were kind of haunting me or basically on my shoulder. It was that chip that I carried on my shoulder to, not let them down, because that was, it was such deep ingrained rooted programming, of, you know, carry on the legacy of your grandfather. You know, the idea of perfection was so heavily rooted that I not only became a dentist, but I became, you know, a cosmetic dentist. You know, that was the first, you know, a part in my early years of my career. And, you know, transcended, you know, all realms of what traditional success would actually look like. Having, you know, that sort of image in the back of my head for most of my 20s after they had passed.
How did you finally let it go?
Yeah, so that, you know, that basically brings us to the second awakening of my life. But it was, you know, I remember it so vividly. It was December 31st, and, you know, I was in my master bedroom of my 5-story home, and. You know, you think December 31st, it's New Year's Eve, everyone's going to go out for a celebration, and we're going to go celebrate the year. And for me, I had literally been fighting this inner dialogue with myself for months, and in actuality it was years, you know, because from the outside it looked like everything was perfect. You know, at this point of my life, I was 28. I had achieved everything that anybody could say about traditional success. You know, I had the $1 million practice. I was married at the time. I had a 5-story home. I had the fancy cars. I had, you know, the first class travel. I had it all. But what I really did not know was I had no idea who I was. And so when I was looking at the mirror on December 31st, that day, that evening, I was alone by myself. I had clothes just kind of, you know, all over the place in my bedroom. And I was sobbing, and I was sobbing for the first time, just uncontrollably. And it was really that it hit me that, you know, for so many years of my life, I was living my life for other people. I was living my life to, you know, as a growing up as a, you know, Asian first generation American, you know, you're trying to please other people. And I was really trying to do that for my family, because that was the upbringing, that the dogma that I kind of, you know, gathered was, to be happy, you need to please your elders, you need to please your family. And so, you know, that meant to become a doctor, that meant to succeed in everything. What I did not know was how in such a rut I was actually in a toxic relationship. And things got so dangerous that I actually needed to leave. And so that was the first time in my life that I literally packed my bags, and that would be the last day that I would actually set foot in my house, in that life. And, you know, and I would leave. And that would be the first time in my life that I'm making this decision for myself without anybody else. And you know, and there was so much fear around that. And there was so much fear because I had worked so hard on the external end and on the professional front. What would people think about me was obviously the first thing. Would I be judged? My family didn't know. My brother, my only living relative, literally he had no idea that I was you know, going through this. And so there was a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. But you know, I'll tell you, it was after, you know, that sort of reconciled, that was literally the best day of my life, because it was, you know, it was like Neetha 2.0 was emerging finally for herself. And, you know, it took those years, kind of after, in the building blocks of really self-discovery, to realize, and rebirth, to where, you know, where I am today. So,
Yeah. So you mentioned that you lost a brother and both parents before you were even 19 years old. I mean, that's something incredibly tragic before the time that you're even truly an adult. And at the same time, you have the coexistence of reaching sort of the heights of success, you know, shortly thereafter. How did you navigate the sort of grief and the success coexisting at the same time? And, you know, I don't imagine in my mind that there's ever a point where you're like, yeah, I'm over this. Something as tragic as losing a parent. So, you know, how do you build the resilience to move on from something like that, especially when it happens as early as it does in your life?
Yeah, you know, it was a series of a lot of different things, and I'll tell you, you know, when I hit that melting point or that turning point, you know, that's really when I realized I hadn't grieved. I had not grieved. You know, I kind of took each death and each, literally bad news, because my mother passed away from cancer, and she had a long battle with breast cancer, you know, from 10 years old to 16, she was in and out of the ICU. So we basically grew up, on her hospital bedside. And so, and that was really, really informing me of, okay, how do you deal with, human dynamics? And my own little research mind was kind of working, because I wanted to make this woman happy while she was on her deathbed. And, you know, as you know, cynical as it sounds right now, that's kind of, you know, you're kind of thrown into the throes of your own humanity of, okay, how can you lessen the pain for somebody else? But it's your mother. And, you know, a year after that, you know, I have my brother passed away right just, I mean, on the spot of an asthma attack. And so it's almost as if, when I look back at it now, it's like you have no choice, but you go into survival mode, and you go into pure survival mode of, okay, things will get better. Things will get better. And I think I shared with you, faith was one of those things that I had. You know, it was, you know, from evangelical Christians that were reaching out to the Hare Krishna temple that was like in our area. I mean, whatever you can, kind of grapple onto, to say, you know what, this is going to be okay. And that was this internal, innate motivation that I had, for my younger brother and I, because I literally became the head of the household. My father fell into a depression and, couldn't take care of the family. I was at that point, you know, at 17, working 3 jobs just to support everybody, and try to take care of me. And so what I thought and what I valued and what I prioritized was, okay, success. So when I'm, you know, when I was hustling at 17 years old, trying to get it all done, myself took a back seat for about a decade, which then entering my 20s, I wanted to create a family that I'd lost. And that was the truth of it. You know, the family that I had lost, I never even knew what my favorite color was. And I look back and, as I teach this to other professionals now, you know, I can see, a lot of, wow, we sometimes we just really don't pay attention to ourselves because we're so focused on either the external or, the next steps that we lose sight of who we really, really are. And for myself, it had been layers upon layers upon layers of, you know, living life for just trying to make it to the next step and the next step and the next step. And where, yes, a lot of the resilience was built. But I didn't grieve until it was that night of, you know, December 31st, when everything just kind of came crumbling down. And I was really faced with, being in a very dangerous, toxic relationship where I had to leave. And then it took, you know, the rest of, you know, the deep work of 5 years of self-discovery and meditation and yoga and psychedelics and, you know, different modes of healing with different people around the world, to really, you know, come to a place of, you know, self-love and service and where we are today.
Hmm. When you lost your parents and your brother, so early, did it change the way that you thought about the time that you have left?
Yeah, it was, you do think about that. You think about death in a very different way because, you know, you think of really impermanence. And that was one of the key characteristics that I learned early on was, you know, wow, we don't have, that much time. And if we don't have that much time, what can we be doing? And so for me in that world of my programming, it was, okay, create a lifestyle for my brother and I. And you know, this was all in the traditional realms of success, but you know, for each season of adversity or resilience that, you know, I had faced with, you know, my marriage and the marriage falling apart, that's really when I said, you know, I started taking up, you know, different types of things and really living life, you know, to the fullest, because I had reached, you know, anything from a monetarily perspective, and being, you know, 28 and having, you know, the millions and the fancy cars, the travel, all of those things. But what I didn't have was the fulfillment of myself and to really know what that was like. And so, which really set me off on a journey to, you know, travel to 40 different countries and start my own research process and my own self-discovery of what that purpose really meant. And for me, what I found was I ended up interviewing close to 500 different people who were leaders in their own right, entrepreneurs, you know, Fortune 500 executives to community builders, community leaders, single moms of, you know, what is it? What makes you truly, you know, successful? What makes you stand out? And how do you rise above adversity? And, you know, out of all of the characteristics, it was resilience that really was the number one characteristic. And you know, this was part research project for my own soul. And but the other half of it was really informing me of, okay, this is something, you know, our emotions aren't really talked about, you know, from a, you know, I went to traditional schooling, medical school, dental school, and you're not talking about that in school. And I had gone through my own personal journey of all of these, tragic events. And, you know, from the external society standards, you still had to put a smile on your face. And so the idea of, you know, being able to understand your emotions, that was kind of foreign to me, until I kind of did this whole, you know, deep dive into what would be, my next project and my next passion project of life, which is, you know, really understanding, emotional resilience and then writing my first book on all of the findings that I had, because then I was so curious about this and so curious about how leaders make decisions based on their emotions and make decisions based on, you know, the types of relationships that they have and the types of connections that they have, good or bad. And that, you know, that led me to my now second, I guess you could say, life, which is my book and my work around emotional grit. Mm-hmm.
So a couple of different things from this. You know, we're talking about external success, and I'm thinking about this right now in particular because I just put a post on Facebook yesterday. My next book comes out August 7th. And there's this moment of, okay, here's that moment in which I get to share and put something on display for the world. And of course, hundreds of comments and likes. And at the same time, there is part of me that thinks, okay, yeah, this is just one like dimension of who I am and what the whole story is. Yeah. And I wonder, you know, from your perspective, you know, when you've got a world in which all of our lives are publicly on display, how does it alter your view of success? How do you think about it now? Because, you know, you sort of achieve what you would call the trappings of success when we didn't live in this world where it was possible to display all of this stuff publicly. Mm-hmm. And now we do. And at moments, I can't help but think, okay, what we've done is simply just traded one definition of success for another.
Right. The
and
likes.
I just wonder. Yeah. I mean, and you know, the thing that, and then, you know, I followed up this morning by saying, the thing is that we, despite being more connected than we've ever been or more isolated than we've ever been, we've replaced, yeah, you know, digital human connections with digital ones. And as we've increased our ability to communicate at scale, we're losing our ability to communicate with depth.
So true.
And these things concern me. And I, you know, I'm kind of, so I'm just wondering what you have to say about all this.
Yeah. You know, I mean, gosh, it's so true. I think that for me, you know, for the longest time I was, you know, living such a lie because I was so fearful of the world. I was so fearful of, you know, putting things out and even showcasing any sort of vulnerability because, you know, the deep programming that I grew up with was, you know, everything's perfect on the outside. There's nothing wrong. You know, even though you had a loss or two or three, everything is fine. And what, you know, that relationship or my first marriage really taught me was laying it all out on the table and being fully vulnerable. And, you know, I think that, it's kind of a different perspective of what you're actually, you know, kind of sharing, but I'm going to tie it in. But you know, it's now the way that I live my life is so, it's very transparent. And, you know, some people say, wow, you put everything on social media and or Facebook or whatever. But, you know, my intention is not, you know, for the likes. My intention is to create that depth. And I'm very aware of, you know, the loneliness and the clickbaits and all of those things that, you know, we have to be cognizant of, especially if you are in the realm of you know, transforming lives or leading others. But, you know, for a very, very long time, especially throughout, you know, that tumultuous time in my life, I was so afraid of even sharing what my emotions really were. And so to go the complete opposite spectrum and share when I'm not having a good day, or share how to really process an emotion, or share how, hey, you know, I was going through this thing, and, you know, we're in the middle of, we travel a lot, my now husband and I, and, you know, the different nuances of travel while you're an entrepreneur. So it's not the perfect social media story, but it's real life. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm currently expecting my first child. I'm 6.5 months pregnant. And so, it's shifted so much of now, the types of things that I am sharing, where it's, you know, it's all deep connections, and it's all, you know, what does this actually mean, and what's the deeper meaning behind it? Because I think that's all we have, and that's what we can do to really combat this whole, I should say, game of likes that we're in this cog of where that is. So I feel like deep authenticity and vulnerability are my solutions to that.
All right. So let's talk about emotional grit and resilience. The thing that seems to keep coming up in my mind, I mean, you talked about resilience with 500 plus people. I feel like I've pretty much done nothing but talk about resilience with everybody that I've ever spoken to.
which is awesome. That's why I'm so excited to be on your show.
The thing that seems to keep coming up over and over for me is that resilience gets built through traumatic experiences. And it seems like that's the only way, you know, it's that whole sort of the only way out is by going through. And do you find that to be the case? And how do people build a capacity for resilience when shitty things are eventually inevitably going to happen? We're all going to lose a parent at some point or another, maybe not as early as you did, but it's going to happen. And I've been trying to figure out how to make my peace with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of big points that I share with folks around this, and the first is, you know, change is constant, and the sooner we accept that change is going to be inevitable, that, you know, excuse me, for instance, impermanence is something where, you know, you have the, and I'm getting a little bit philosophical here and spiritual, but we're not here for that long. And what it was such a valuable gift for me to learn about impermanence at an early age, has now kind of helped steer a lot of these conversations, because these conversations, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have about death, or about extreme adversity and what that actually looks like. But, you know, the other aspect is also being able to, you know, to not take yourself so seriously. And humor plays a humongous role in resilience, which is why, one of the things that I just started actually this year was playing around with that concept of play, because, you know, talking about obviously this entire journey, it has always been so serious and so serious talking about, you know, teaching people how to build resilience on, you know, you know, embracing all the challenges that they've had and being able to bounce back with grit and tenacity and fervor and all of these things. But what about taking yourself, you know, out of the equation and just being able to laugh at yourself and maybe be able to laugh at some of the most serious things that can happen and, you know, infusing humor in that way. And I've become so fascinated with how stand-up comics actually utilize a lot of their hardest life stories into, you know, beautiful prose and monologues for, you know, a lot of their storytelling. And I actually took a stand-up class, and an improv, that was kind of some of the initial, things that I did, but I actually dove in and took a stand-up class earlier this year just so I can understand, you know, some of the dynamics of how we can infuse more humor into the work that we're doing. Because I do a lot of these different workshops. And so I'm constantly, you know, trying to keep up, but this was primarily to actually share content in a different way. And so I created a spoof series on the lives of entrepreneurs and, coaches and consultants, people who are kind of in service and transformation. And so, yeah.
Wow. So having had the childhood that you did, having lost your parents and now about to be a mother, what impact do you think that's all going to have on the way that you're going to raise your kid?
You know, it's I think I'm going to go with the philosophy of the unparent. how do you unparent yourself and unparent your child? Because there's just so much, you know, there's all of these expectations and it's so interesting because going through this journey of being pregnant and, you know, creating a mini human and getting ready for that to be part of our next life and our next phase of our life, in parenting, it's really kind of changed the way that, I view now expectations or what my desires are, because I look back on, wow, you know, I grew up so fast. And you know, a lot of my childhood, I didn't really have in certain ways. And so, you know, being very, very cognizant and very intentional of how I, you know, I want to have and guide this little human into the world. And so my partner and I, we've had extensive talks about this, because also being in the transformation space and being coaches and teachers and leaders, yeah, and, you know, and knowing a little bit of, conscious, you know, development or parenting or whatever, it seems like there's another expectation that they should be meditating and doing all these things, but, when they're in the womb. But I think it's really to take it back a step, and because there's even all of that pressure on, well, what you should be doing now while he's in the womb and all these things. And I think it's such a great reminder of, okay, A, is your ego getting in the way? That's number one. And two, what parts of your childhood have not been resolved? And so that aspect has been coming up so much for the both of us, as we navigate, you know, these kinds of challenges. And so, so that's been something that, you know, we've had as far as, you know, talking about things, because, yeah, I mean, it's all happening kind of right before our eyes, and these are different conversations that we've never even thought of. And what is it more for us that, you know, that deserves a little bit more tender care and, you know, and reflection and insight.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I always ask the question to people I'm talking to was for the very reason that you brought up, that, you know, we're talking to people who are transformational leaders, authors. So you think that, okay, you know what, if I had parents who understood all this, I would have turned out completely normal. And it turns out that that is the furthest thing from the truth. Like, one person said parenting is a giant shit show. That's literally how Sarah Peck described it to me. And I thought, okay, fair enough. And Phil McKernan, another guest, said, no matter what you do, you're going to fuck your kids up. And I was like, awesome, great, like, this is all useful to know. But it's interesting to always hear it from people who are in this world, because you're right, I think the expectation, especially for so many of us who've been exposed to this, we always wonder, like, wow, if my parents had actually known all this, maybe I would have turned out a little bit different. But then there's a part of me that says, well, I probably wouldn't have sought out this information in the first place if my parents were like that.
Exactly. I don't think we would have had, you know, the where we are today if it wasn't based on all of the things that we had to go through. And I'm a firm believer of that 1,000%. But I do agree with some of your guests that, you know, they might still need therapy or some sort of healing, because we might do something subconsciously, unconsciously, and being okay that might happen. I think that's the biggest part.
Wow. All right. So I have two more questions for you. Earlier in our conversation, you alluded to being a dancer. You mentioned music lessons. What I'm curious about is what habits, disciplines, and mindsets you cultivated from those creative pursuits early in your life that are part of your life today.
Yes. So, well, actually, it's the first I would probably say is discipline. There were times where it was every single morning or after school, you had some sort of practice. And, you know, for these recitals or things like that, it was constant practice. And so, that was all, you know, I think that movement has always been a part of my life. And even now the habits that I have, being with baby, in my tummy, that has not changed. And, you know, health has always been that sort of, big priority for me, obviously, because, of my own experiences with loss, where self-care and really having a morning routine has really been a huge part, because, you know, where it's not faith related anymore, but, you know, having a meditation practice or a breathing practice, a gratitude, you know, exercise and journal, these are all part of my morning routine, but also bringing and taking the element of movement, not so much dance anymore, although I still love it, but in the form of, you know, either Qigong or yoga or, you know, any sort of movement that gets the body moving. I've been in Europe for about 7 weeks now, and I've been doing about 5 miles of walking a day. And so I am very, very active. I used to do triathlons and 100-mile century bike rides. So that's movement and the love of exercise have always been kind of staples in my life. I think it's been very meditative, but I do get a lot of my biggest insights where, you know, whether it's creative work while I'm doing like long distance things, whether it's walking or biking or even swimming. And so that has been, that's been a gem that has been a big part of my life so far.
Amazing. Well, I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I definitely think it's their ability to be 100% authentic and truthful with whatever they believe, whatever they stand for, and whatever their stories are.
Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to what has been a very poetic and thought-provoking conversation. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Oh, Well, you can definitely hop on the interwebs and go to neetabhushan.com. It's NEETABHUSHAN.com, or it's probably easier to go to School of Grit, GRIT.TV. And that's where you can find a lot of our funny spoof episodes.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.